Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with one of the leading experts on U.S.-Russian relations, Angela Stent, who served as an advisor on Russia under Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and maintains close ties with key policymakers in both countries. We'll examine the crisis over Russia's annexation of Crimea and the likelihood of worsening relations between the two former rival Cold War superpowers, and discuss her new book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, which is an inside look into the recent post-Cold War history of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama's dealings with Russia under Boris Yeltsin and Vladimir Putin. Then finally, we'll examine the deepening rift between Qatar and its Arab neighbors, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Kuwait, and Bahrain, as well as Egypt. Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss conflict within the Six-Nation Gulf Cooperation Council, which mirrors a larger Middle Eastern struggle over systems of governance that has been playing out across the region since the Arab Spring. Joining us now in studio is Angela Stent, the director of the Center of Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-chairs the Hewitt Forum on Post-Soviet Affairs. From 2004 to 2006, she served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State. She's the author of the new book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Angela Stent.
Well, delighted to be here.
And I suppose in many ways that moment with Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia in Geneva back in 2009, with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton giving him the gift box with the button inside that was said in Russian, supposedly it said reset, but Lavrov corrected her and said actually it means overload. And of course, in many ways, that accident ends up being somewhat prophetic, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. The mistranslation by whoever did it in the U.S. government was indeed prophetic. And in fact, the next day after she'd given that button to Sergei Lavrov, a major Russian newspaper published an article under the headline, Clinton and Lavrov Pushed the Wrong Button. But on the other hand, I would say in the first Obama term, things worked quite well with Russia. And they really started to become unraveled when Mr. Putin announced that he was going back to the Kremlin.
So what happened, though, seems to have soured that relationship with Libya, wasn't it? And my understanding is that also that soured Putin's relationship with Medvedev.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that Medvedev, for whatever reason, decided that Russia would abstain on that crucial vote that allowed the no-fly zone and then led to the downfall of Gaddafi. And clearly, almost immediately afterwards, Mr. Putin came out and talked about crusades and people marching into places and deposing people. I've been part of a group for the last 10 years, and we've met every year with Mr. Putin. We've had dinner with him. And I remember when he described what happened to Gaddafi the next year when we met with him. And he was really, you could see on his face that he found this outrageous and really thought it was shocking that that had happened. So that certainly soured it. And I think a number of people believe that that was when he openly broke, if you like, with Mr. Medvedev, although that's not what he said. He said all along they were going to switch places. So I think we don't know the truth about that yet.
So that leads me to, I guess, the 900-pound gorilla in the room question. Is there a subtext to what happened to Gaddafi and then what happened to Yanukovych and that it could happen to him? Is that what's going on here?
I think a theme throughout his presidency, well, particularly following the first color revolution in Georgia in 2003, and particularly when there was a color revolution in 2004 in Ukraine, he has come to believe that the United States is in the business of regime change. He looks at the Iraq War. He looks at these color revolutions. He looks at what happened in Libya. He looks at what's happening now in Ukraine. And he thinks that the U.S. is out to impose governments that it favors in different parts of the world, including on his back door. And I think the ultimate concern is the United States' ultimate goal to replace the current regime in Russia.
So, and I'm sure you've done this, you've been with the American delegations trying to dissuade Vladimir Putin. What kind of arguments have you made?
Well, I mean, you know, tries to explain that this is not the U.S. goal, that the U.S. is trying to, if we're talking about Russia's backyard, support the sovereignty and the independence and the viability of these post-Soviet states. But I think that's not how the Kremlin sees it. And it's always been suspicious. I think an anecdote to explain this is during the Ukrainian color revolution in 2004, the Russians put out statements all the time saying that who was behind this color revolution? It was this conjoining of forces between President Bush and George Soros. Now, George Soros, obviously a major financier of NGOs and democracy building in the post-Soviet world, utterly opposed to President Bush, spent a lot of his own money trying to make sure that he was defeated in the 2004 election. But their idea is they will look at these two figures and think that, well, they must actually be in cahoots, showing a total misunderstanding of the way that U.S. politics works.
So if we're trying to, at least in my mind, we're trying to figure out how personal this is or how geopolitical it is, and it's very difficult for me to tell with Putin. But I think in terms of geopolitics, it is pretty clear that NATO is inexorably moved east, has it not? And was that, do you think, a historic mistake, as many have said?
Well, if you go back to the Gorbachev time, right, Mr. Gorbachev believes that a promise was made to the Soviet Union in the time of German unification that NATO would not expand. I wrote my previous book on Soviet-German relations and German reunification, and there were absolutely no written agreements on that. This is maybe what Mr. Gorbachev understood. There was only a promise at the time that NATO troops wouldn't be stationed in the former East Germany. Now, then you fast forward to the Clinton administration, and obviously, this is a controversial issue. On the one hand, and I believe that Poland and the Czech Republic and Hungary and the Baltic states, they had the right to choose what alliance they wanted to be in, given their history and given the fact that they were sort of floating around there, not in any alliance structure. On the other hand, I do think more could have been done to include Russia in and give it a stake in a new Euro-Atlantic security system. I mean, there is a NATO-Russia Council, and there's been one since 1997, but it's not never worked very well. I think the U.S. could also seriously have offered Russia the prospect of NATO membership. And in my book, I describe when I worked in policy planning, we in fact did work on a plan on that. Obviously, it didn't go anywhere. So I wouldn't criticize the enlargement of NATO. I would criticize the lack of imagination or initiative among the NATO partners to offer Russia a deal which would have given it a bigger stake in the stability of this post-Cold War system that we see now unraveling in Crimea.
But could you have had a kind of military vacuum in that? Because after all, the Warsaw Pact disappeared, but NATO didn't. So one would just assume that from the Russian point of view, they either you have a neutral zone in that vacuum or something that they can accept fills it.
Yes, I think the Russians probably hoped that NATO would disband. And they've always said, well, why did you need NATO after 1992? There was no more Warsaw Pact. You didn't need to have two blocks. Or they, you know, had hoped that that zone would be neutral. But the problem is, if you look at history and you look at the history of Russia's relations with the Baltic states, with Poland, also with Czechoslovakia, as it then was, and Hungary, you can understand why those countries feared being, you know, in a neutral zone where they didn't have guarantees from NATO. Of course, the subtext was they wanted those guarantees against future Russian, potential Russian aggression, even though the U.S. and the other sort of traditional, the old NATO members, if you liked, always said, well, no, this is not against Russia. It's just to increase stability here. I think the other subtext of NATO was in order to join all of these countries who'd had lots of ethnic rivalries and where they'd been ethnic cleansing before, they had to promise that they would resolve these issues. And so one good thing I think that joining NATO did was to make sure that, you know, Hungarians and Romanians weren't going to face each other fighting each other. But I think that subtext was probably lost on the Russians.
So just to touch on the current crisis, which could get worse. I mean, some of the stuff that's coming out of the foreign ministry is ominous. They did the same with Crimea. They talked about pogroms against Russian speakers and fascists and anti-Semites rampaging around. Clearly, it wasn't true in Crimea. And it doesn't appear to be true in at least in eastern Ukraine, but that hasn't stopped the propaganda machine from churning out this stuff. My understanding is that Putin is riding high in the polls in Russia. He's never been more popular. Tremendous amount of nationalism, a sense of pride, even macho is going on there. A lonely protester tried to protest in the street, and he was spat on and cursed, and his placard saying no war was ripped from his hands. So I guess the questions again go back to my dilemma. Is this a greater Russian geopolitical move out of a sense of NATO encroachment, or is this President Putin striking out? He saw what happened to Yanukovych, and he doesn't want it to happen to him, and he's distracted the entire Russian people now.
Right. Well, it's all of the above, and you're quite right. His popularity went up 8 points in the last week. He stands now, I believe, around 70%, something that the U.S. president could only dream about. This has been a popular movement at home, domestically. It's revived people's sense of pride in Russia. They look at Crimea, and they understand that Crimea was, of course, traditionally part of Russia. It's majority Russian-speaking, and I think all of the resentments against the West have all come to the fore there. One anecdote on this. In 2008, I taught a class at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations. And these are the elite young people who are going to go into the foreign ministry, the defense ministry, other parts of the Russian government. Not one of these young people born after the Soviet Union collapsed believed that the Soviet Union had collapsed because of its own internal weaknesses. They all believed that this was the result of the actions of the United States and its intelligence services. So if you have even a younger generation that sees somehow that this was a plot, that the Soviet Union collapsed because of a plot, and now if you can reclaim at least part of Ukraine, you're reclaiming really what's rightfully yours. That obviously is really going to increase support for Mr. Putin. And on all of the stories that you hear from Moscow about what's really happening, there's obviously a kernel of truth. Some of the groups in Kiev, out on the square, are extreme right wing, are probably, you know, pro-fascist and are anti-Semites. But that's a very small group. The majority of these people do not share those views, and the majority of the interim government doesn't. But they've been able to sort of whip this up into a frenzy. And you see all the posters, people say in Crimea they're voting against fascism and for Russia. Well, if you present it in terms like that, then it's clear what the answer is going to be. And I think from Mr. Putin's point of view, he was so shocked having offered $15 billion to Mr. Yanukovych and thought that he had a deal with him. He wouldn't sign an agreement with the European Union. He'd move closer to Russia. To see that come unraveled in February, and then to see an agreement signed on February the 21st with the European foreign ministers and his own representative, which would have included Yanukovych until an election in December, and the next day to see him flee. Now, we don't really know why that happened, but that comes back to, you know, your point that if it can happen there, it could happen in Russia too.
But the reason it happened in Ukraine, I think, largely was to do with the disgust at this kleptocracy, this family. The older son, the dentist, was shaking down all of the oligarchs. They stole, 10% of the GDP? Mm-hmm. We don't know how much they stole. And I spoke yesterday to Bill Browder, who knows Russia pretty well. He was the biggest investor in Russia until 2005. And he said that that was a defining moment for Putin, because what Putin's concerned about is that he's going to suffer that same fate because he has even bigger palaces and has stashed away even more money than Yanukovych has.
Well, one can argue about the sums, the figures, but certainly the kind of corrupt regime that existed and still exists in Kiev, in Ukraine, exists in practically all of the post-Soviet space, in all of those countries. And obviously, there are huge questions in Russia, whether the system is, the close relationship between political and economic elites, vast assets, some of them abroad, some of them in Russia. So yes, there would be a concern that if people can unravel and expose the corruption in Ukraine, they could do it in Russia too. And sometimes they've occasionally tried to do it, but so far not successfully.
Well, Navalny came up with the phrase that the party of crooks and swindlers, right? And that has resonated with the intelligentsia, but not with the narod, not with the rest of the country.
I think that's true, because I think exactly the educated urban elites understand that, and they understand that there's a huge scale of corruption. The narod, the people, I mean, they live in a country where you expect everybody wants to take bribes. You don't expect people to be honest. But I think somehow they don't quite believe that there's some huge, massive corruption on the part of the top leadership. And even though exposés come out and people publish things on the internet, and then some of them leave Russia and they publish them in the Financial Times. I think the people who support him probably don't really have exposure to those kinds of reports.
Well, they don't exactly have investigative journalism there. Putin controls the entire press except for Novaya Gazeta.
Right, they don't. And sometimes investigative journalists then, mysteriously get killed. So, yes, it's much harder to expose this kind of thing in Russia because the controls are much tighter than they are in Ukraine.
Well, but what I'm getting at here, Angela Stent, is Putin and Russia have become inextricable. He's he'll be probably the longest serving leader by
2018 is the next election, and if he runs again, he could be there till 2024. Yeah, longer than anyone else.
Right. So the question is, if these rumors, and after all, Masha Gessen wrote a book that was pretty damning, and she actually had a meeting with him in the Kremlin as well. And after listening to Bill Browder yesterday, my head's reeling, the idea that, that perhaps what we have here is what happened, for example, in the great moment of historical appeasement with the Munich meeting between Chamberlain and Hitler. And I'm not suggesting using the word, there's no fascist subtext here that I'm alluding to, but I'm alluding to the fact that Chamberlain was out of the old school British gentleman diplomat, and he simply didn't know that he was dealing with a gangster and a thug. And is it possible that we in the West have been dealing with a gangster and a thug, and because he's the head of a state, et cetera, we sort of gloss over that? Because my sense is that all gangsters crave respect, and we certainly give Putin respect. And the question is, does he deserve it?
Well, I think most Western governments, most Europeans, certainly in the U.S., the people who deal with Russia, they understand what they're dealing with. I don't think we're naive. But I think one thing that's happened is this isn't the Cold War anymore. This is a integrated global economy. And, particularly in Europe, particularly in Great Britain and other European countries, there are huge economic stakes in Russia, as well as Russia obviously having stakes in Europe too. Less so of the United States, but there's still some of that there where you see already groups in the U.S. trying to prevent very tough sanctions from being imposed on Russia. So I think people have a pretty good idea about what they're dealing with. But on the other hand, Russia remains a nuclear superpower. It has a veto in the United Nations Security Council. It has huge reserves of oil and gas. So it really does have levers that it can also exert in the world. It can also make it much more difficult for the U.S. and its allies to achieve some of their goals in other areas, for instance, Iran, Syria, other issues we could talk about. So even though people know what they're dealing with, there are other equities involved in this, and that, I think, restrains or constrains the degree to which one is going to confront Russia.
Even though, in effect, Russia is Putin. Isn't that the problem? I mean, you have just suggested there's more to Russia than Putin, but he seems to be so powerful and have such personal power.
Well, he's not all powerful. He's the single most powerful person in Russia. But the system exists because they're different groups of people, oligarchs, now many from the security services, who support him. And he sort of also is an arbiter between these different groups. And coming back to the question of, what might happen in the future, of course, if the assets of these people are frozen abroad, if they cannot visit countries, visit their mansions in London or whatever, then they might start to rethink, is it really worthwhile? Should we be supporting the system? Because we've done rather well out of it, but we don't want to our assets and our livelihood to be endangered. And that could in the future put some pressure on the system and could maybe lead to change. But that's far off in the future. And so right now, it's in the interests of most of the groups who support Putin to continue supporting him so that they continue to enjoy their lifestyles.
Well, the dissident chess master, Garry Kasparov, said Putin is afraid of banks, not tanks. So I mean, are you making that point?
I think, yes, I think that's true as well. He is a, yeah, I agree. I don't think he fears that anyone's going to come and, you know, no one's going to go to war with Russia. And that's why, though, in since he came back to the Kremlin, he has encouraged all of his supporters there, all of these different kinds of oligarchs, to repatriate their money into Russia because they were quite vulnerable having so many assets abroad. But still many of them do.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Angela Stent. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing our conversation with Angela Stent, who joins me in the studio. So, Angela Stent, again, the author of the new book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. We talked earlier about Putin's relationship with Obama souring over Libya, and it perhaps affected his relationship with his prime minister, Medvedev, or who was then, of course, president, and they've switched sides, and many people thought that Putin was in charge all along in any case. But just turning to Syria, do you think that Obama was had over Syria? I mean, a lot of people do, that basically the deal we made, only 4% of these chemical weapons have been handed over, and the deal itself ensures Assad's survival because he knows where the chemical weapons are. So it was like a deal that essentially, you know, ensconced Assad, who is indispensable to the deal, but he's also the main cause of the problem.
Well, it's true. I mean, if you look back, first of all, I would just make the point that I think the thing that really ended the reset in the relationship between Obama and Putin was granting Edward Snowden political asylum in Russia. Now, putting that aside, that shortly thereafter, I mean, the problem was that the U.S. government, you know, was unable to make a decision about what to do, as was the British government, because they faced opposition in their legislatures. And so it's I would say it was the hesitation on the part of the U.S. Putin then jumped in. It looked like a face-saving solution. We'll disarm them of their chemical weapons. And now, as you say, that's not working out the way we thought it would. I mean, there was some progress. It now seems to have come to a halt. And since we've now halted, in fact, our own military cooperation with Russia on a number of levels, I don't know how far that will go. Certainly, the Russians have, from the beginning, calculated that Assad would survive, and they're helping him survive by supplying him with all those weapons. And you've heard, you know, a lot of criticism, even before the Crimean events, from Secretary Kerry and President Obama. They may have been had there, but there seemed to be no other way out of this, because on the one hand, you know, there was a possibility of having to use force, having drawn a red line and then stepped back from it on the part of the U.S. administration. But certainly cooperation on Syria right now isn't working.
Well, in turning to your book, Angela Stent, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, start out with George H.W. Bush and the new Russia. But then the real relationship, of course, is your chapter one, The Bill and Boris Show. So there are two questions about that era. One, after spending trillions on winning the Cold War, and obviously, you know, it's a problem to do a victory dance in the end zone. and that's something that has really offended the Russians. But, you know, it felt like we sort of abandoned them. You know, we spent all this money confronting them, and if the strategy was to bankrupt them, then that worked. Why didn't we step in then and secure the victory for democracy and for Russia?
Well, I think one of the criticisms is that there should have been a new Marshall Plan. But if you go back and you talk to, for instance, General Scowcroft, as I have, and the people in the H.W. Bush administration, they will say that the Congress, wasn't interested in that. And one of the themes of my book is that the U.S. Congress has never been interested in the past 22 years in doing very much to help Russia and improve the relationship. It's rather passed legislation that makes it more difficult. So, yes, I mean, you can argue that there should have been much more economic assistance, particularly in the beginning. There was some democracy assistance. Then, of course, you can argue about the economic advice that was given by the U.S., namely supporting shock therapy and this rather difficult transition away from a Soviet-planned economy, which left millions of people impoverished there. And there's a lot of criticism. Maybe the U.S. shouldn't have supported that. There should have been a gradual transition. But I suppose the people who were then in power in Russia really didn't believe that. I think the problem in the 1990s is we did quite a lot domestically in trying to help build democracy in Russia. But then, of course, came the Balkan Wars. And I think one of the very neuralgic parts for Yeltsin, and you see some of that playing out today in Ukraine, is particularly in Kosovo, less so in Bosnia, but Russia was forced to accept an agenda, written in Washington or Brussels, at least, NATO, and go to war, essentially, or support a war against Serbia in the case of Kosovo. And it felt very humiliated by that. And I think that's how that Bill and Boris reset ended, was just over the Kosovo war and Russia feeling that its traditional partner, ally Serbia, its interests had been completely disregarded.
And, of course, that comes up now as an analogy, mm-hmm. that NATO bombed Serbia and Kosovo was a part of Serbia, and yet it was carved off, so therefore it's
became independent.
Yes, so right. We can do the same thing in Crimea.
Right, and exactly that's what they're coming back. Of course, there are lots of analogies. We have a war of words going on at the moment vis-a-vis Ukraine and Crimea, and that people throw analogies around. It's probably not a very good idea to make the analogies, but in the Kosovo case, of course, you could say there was a long period of negotiations. I mean, in the end, the Russians wouldn't agree to support it, but there was a long period of negotiations, and its independence was recognized by a significant number of countries, although obviously not all of them, whereas what's happening in Crimea has been done, at the barrel of a gun, so to speak. But those analogies are always there.
So in terms of the Boris and Bill show, were we too focused on the incredibly remote possibility of communism returning and just sort of turned a blind eye to the oligarchical rampage, the theft of national assets or the appropriation of national mm-hmm. assets and all these overnight billionaires? Because one of the things I understand is towards the end, Yeltsin, having hired Putin, had sort of buyer's remorse at the very end.
Well, we certainly – in 1996, there was an election, right? And Yeltsin's numbers were in the single digits, and it looked as if the communists would win. And it is true that the major focus of the U.S. was that the communists should not come back to power. And in the end, Dick Morris, who'd at one point also advised President Clinton on various election strategies, one of his teams went and advised the Yeltsin team, and so that he went from single digits to winning in the second round of the elections, even though he was really quite ill. By the time Mr. Putin took over, Yeltsin was obviously in ill health, and that's why he resigned prematurely. One does understand from what he subsequently said that he did have some buyer's remorse. But at the time, they believed that Mr. Putin would come in and that he would be, he was orderly, organized, but he wouldn't try and assert himself too much, and there wouldn't be, the system.
He'd be like a technician or a technocrat.
A technician. I mean, you can say, the corrupt system that exists in Russia today began under Yeltsin. It did not begin under Putin. But of course, it was a different group of oligarchs. Yeah, they thought he'd be maybe more of a technician and that he wouldn't clamp down so much domestically as he's done or exert the kind of controls that you can see now.
And in those early days, what was your sense then of George W. Bush looking into his eyes and seeing his soul? I mean, did again we get had, or did the president get had, or did he not see the real soul?
Well, I think when Putin first came in, he had a series of meetings with Western leaders, Europeans and Americans, and he said he wanted Russia to be integrated into the West, to the global economy. He said Russia's a European country. And so in the beginning, people believed that he really meant that. And maybe he really did mean it. I mean, we can argue about that. I think the first time he met President Bush, when President Bush made that remark that he later came to regret in Slovenia, it was his first trip to Europe, President Bush's. He had been derided by most of the major European leaders, including particularly Chancellor Gerhard Schröder. And then he met Vladimir Putin, and Putin was very respectful. He really knew how to handle George Bush, I would say, and talk to him. They talked about religion and various other things. So, but I do think that what Putin believed when he offered, when he was the first foreign leader to call the United States after the terrorist attacks on 9/11 and offer Russia as a partner in the war on terror, I think he really did believe that this would be, as one of the Russians I quote describes in my book, an equal partnership of unequals. In other words, the U.S. would treat Russia as an equal, as a strategic partner, that we'd be allies like we were in World War II, where we had a common enemy. And then what disappointed him was, and that worked, you know, for maybe about 6 months in the first phase of the war in Afghanistan, when Russia was an important partner. And then he saw the Bush administration deriding traditional arms control agreements. They weren't interested in that. Then the invasion of Iraq, then the color revolutions, and that all, again, added up to the specter of regime change, not only in Iraq, but in Russia itself. So I think that Putin did have expectations that were then disappointed. They maybe were not expectations that the U.S. understood. But I do believe in the beginning, he did have a hope of having a better relationship with the United States. And that's why I say that that third reset was really inaugurated by him.
Well, just in closing, Angela Stent, your book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, couldn't be more timely. And my sense is that U.S.-Russian scholarship is going to come back, isn't it? I mean, it may be the worst possible way if things get – we have a new Cold War. But, I mean, I don't mean to be – ironic here, but...
Well, certainly Kremlinology will come back. It probably never died, but in the 90s, you didn't need to, you know, the country was more open, so the kind of Kremlinology and those skills that you had in the Cold War were not needed as much. Certainly, it's coming back now, and I think the danger is that because the Cold War ended and because nobody thought Russia was going to be a problem anymore, we really don't have enough younger people who are trained as experts in this field. Many of us have been doing this for a long time. So I think it's possible that as a result of this crisis, you know, we will understand the need to have more specialists in Russia, you know, who understand as much as they can about how the Kremlin functions and Russia's neighbors too, and to forget that Russia remains a very important country and will remain so for a long time.
Well, let's hope we don't have to read the Kremlin tea leaves what we did in the Cold War. We can actually sit across from them and talk to them. I mean, it does seem that it will be impossible to turn the clock back that much.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, the Soviet Union isn't going to be restored. Russia is a capitalist country of some sort. It's not going to have that kind of closed economy. And even though it does have a pretty authoritarian political system, I mean, the internet is still rather free. There are lots of interesting discussions. You can see there's one radio station where you hear lots of dissenting views. So it's not the Soviet Union. It's not going to be the Soviet Union. People can travel to and from Russia. They have personal freedoms that they never had before. So, you know, and the hope is that will continue. It may take more generations than we thought for Russia to become less authoritarian, but I'm sure eventually it will.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Angela Stent. Again, I've been speaking with Angela Stent, who's the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Affairs and a professor of government and foreign affairs at Georgetown University. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-chairs its Hewitt Forum on Post-Soviet Affairs. And from 2004 to 2006, she served as National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. And from 1999 to 2001, she served in the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Department of State and is the author of the new book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about Saudi Arabia's threat to blockade its neighbor, Qatar.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy, and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Jones.
It's good to be with you again, Ian.
And Saudi Arabia has threatened to blockade its neighbor Qatar by land and sea unless it cuts ties with the Muslim Brotherhood, closes down Al Jazeera, and expels the local branches of two U.S. think tanks, the Brookings Doha Center and RAND Corporation's Qatar Policy Institute. Those are fighting words, aren't they?
Well, they certainly are. This is an escalation. And it's a provocation seemingly out of nowhere. It's not unprecedented that Saudi Arabia has had tense relations with Doha, but this seems to be an escalation.
So they've got the rest of the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, also ganging up on Qatar, as of course is Egypt. So this has got to be a very lonely position for the new young leader of Qatar.
Well, right. I mean, Bahrain is essentially a satellite of Saudi Arabia, so they don't follow an independent line in any event. That the Emirates have supported the Saudis in all of this reflects a certain ideological proximity and hostility toward Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood in particular. It's important, and Egypt kind of at the moment serves a similar role, a kind of dependency or satellite to the Saudis, the Egyptian military regime, which, remember, toppled the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood in coming to power, is also largely dependent on Saudi largesse at this point. But the Omanis have certainly not towed the line. There is not consensus within the GCC about how to handle everything all the time, although there seems to be at least a small group of countries willing to follow Saudi Arabia's line here.
Well, the Saudis, of course, are heavily backing the Egyptian regime, which just deposed the Muslim Brotherhood, which was heavily backed by Qatar and supported with a lot of propaganda and news coverage, positive news coverage, by Al Jazeera, not necessarily by the English version, which we see over here, but certainly by the Arab language version. My sense is that the Saudis seem to be taking on this massive burden of the Sisi government. Sisi, of course, the military leader in Egypt, who's likely to be the next president. I mean, they're talking about billions and billions that they're going to be needing. Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have spent $32 billion so far with no end in sight. So walk us through what's going on here, both with Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt.
So I think there are two things to keep in mind, very generally, and one you put your finger on, and that is that Saudi Arabia is feeling somewhat muscular in the Arab world and in the Gulf as well, and including its extensions. Part of this, part of Saudi Arabia's regional geopolitics is about confronting Iran, but the other part of it is also about consolidating Riyadh's primacy in the Arab world itself. There have been contests historically between Cairo, some of the other republican regimes, as well as the monarchies in the Gulf. In the 21st century, the Saudis aspire to a position of supremacy, and they've put that on display over the last few years, right, as the region seems to have kind of veered toward the precipice and back. The Saudis were anxious in 2011 as the uprisings began to take shape. But as they've developed or petered out in some cases, the Saudis have sought to consolidate gains in Arab capitals across the region. And they have all kinds of reasons to want to do so. For the most part, it's a good old-fashioned balance of power pursuit of regional primacy. It's not ideological. It's about sustaining and buffering Saudi power in the region. There's also a political economic component to this, and that the Saudis, of course, they benefit in massive ways economically by being the most powerful actor, right? They can control energy markets, they can dictate prices, they can spread their wealth around, and they can also generate wealth by investing in these places as they rebuild and tap back in to Western networks of finance, et cetera. The other part of it is, and I think this is also on display, although it's not obvious, with the particular turn against the Muslim Brotherhood. So frustrations with Qatar have to do, yes, with Qatar's respect for and support for the Brotherhood, not only in Egypt, but also for Islamists in Syria. The Saudi, there's a kind of popular confusion about how Saudi Arabia thinks about its power in the world. Is it an Islamic state? Is it driven by ideology? Is Wahhabism a useful way to think about it? And I don't think any of those things necessarily rise to the level. And that's not the first thing that Saudi policymakers think about. In fact, they view Islamists, in spite of the kind of social contract they have with clerics in their own country, with a great deal of suspicion. And they have a good reason to do so. The Muslim Brotherhood, when it fled Egypt in the 1960s and 1950s, many of its key members sought refuge inside Saudi Arabia. And over the course of the 1960s and 1970s, those Muslim brothers who took up positions in Saudi institutions began targeting the Saudis themselves, calling for an Islamic government, criticizing the El Saud. So the Saudis feel like they've been burned historically by the Muslim Brotherhood. They see them both as a threat in the region to a kind of secular political arrangement, and they see them as a threat at home as the most important ideological force that could undermine their credibility in Riyadh itself.
And, of course, the ultimate product of the Muslim Brotherhood militant theology was Osama bin Laden, in the sense he and Zawahiri came out of the Qutb school, did they not? I mean,
Certainly Zawahiri did, yes. I think that that's generally true in the sense that it's development, it's internal developments at a particularly fraught moment in Egypt in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. That the jihadist strain of the Muslim Brotherhood began to take shape, mostly in Egyptian prisons. So to the extent that the Muslim Brotherhood helped, you know, generate this radicalization, then yes, we can situate Osama bin Laden within that community. But bin Laden was not a Muslim brother. We don't want to buy into Saudi Arabia's language that the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization.
Sure.
But there are all kinds of connections, yes.
Well, he certainly got disgusted with the regime and threw his passport in the king's face. Again, I'm speaking with Toby Jones, a professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle East Project. And from 2004 to early 2006, he worked as a political analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. So you've got what seems to be going on here is that this conflict with between the Six Nation Gulf Cooperation Council in Egypt and Qatar is mirroring a larger Middle Eastern struggle over systems of governance that have been playing out across the regions since the Arab Spring. And also, as I mentioned earlier, you do have this generational gulf, do you not, between the 89-year-old Saudi king versus the 33-year-old new prince or king, I guess, of Qatar.
Well, outwardly, it seems that the generational difference should matter. One of the things I'm very cautious about, in as much as we can make sense of these kind of particular kinds of regional and local struggles, and we can talk with some certainty about political ambition. One thing we can't do, it's very difficult to access, kind of peel back the Saudi and the Qatari version of criminology. Now, we don't know exactly what's driving this hostility at this particular moment. I mean, there are contradictions at work here that don't seem to have anything to do with generational difference. I mean, for example, this is a sudden turn. The Saudis had not only declared a kind of quiet, at least a rhetorical war on Qatar, they've also changed some of their own domestic laws around the Muslim Brotherhood. They've criminalized the Brotherhood. There have been a series of arrests recently, both in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. And they've also threatened to impose heavy fines on any Saudi citizens who go and participate in the jihad abroad. And this is a pretty sudden transformation, given that we know the Saudis have actively been supporting those very networks in Syria, for example. So what exactly is driving this at this particular moment is hard to say. I wouldn't chalk too much of it up to a difference of generational perspective. It seems that the Saudis have some kind of a logic at work that they think they stand to gain in some way by doing this right now. And I'm not sure what it is.
Well, I can't see what they'll gain from closing down the Brookings Doha Center and RAND Corporation's Qatar Policy Institute on the eve of President Obama's trip to Saudi Arabia at the end of the month. I mean, what is their reasoning? Have they said why they want to close down these two Washington think tanks?
Well, this wouldn't be the first time that Washington, that American-based or that European-based think tanks would have been shuttered in the region. And certainly Saudi Arabia has a long history of cracking down on journalism, journalists, and those of us who have done think tank type work there. Bahrain, for example, has closed down several offices, as have the Egyptians. We know about Freedom House and Cairo's crackdown on them several years ago. And if I had to make sense of the Brookings and RAND are not arms or extensions of the Muslim Brotherhood. So on the one hand, it doesn't seem like it would be an extension of that particular approach to regional politics, right? This isn't about Islamism. But both of those places have come out and been consistently critical of both American reluctance to promote or support democratic transitions in the region, and they've been very critical of the kind of deeply entrenched nature of autocracy and authoritarianism, especially in the Persian Gulf. So that's a little too close to home for the Saudis. And Brookings is probably the more visible of the two. At its heart, I think what Saudi Arabia worries about more than anything, and again, keeping in mind that they want to protect both their position in the region, but also the legitimacy and the primacy of the El Saud at home, is they worry about influential networks that are transnational, that speak in a language of human rights and democracy that might somehow appeal inside the region. Now, in saying that, I think the Saudis probably overestimate the actual influence of Brookings and RAND inside Saudi Arabia itself. But if you can shut down all avenues of expression, then I think the Saudis would aspire to that.
Well, it's an awful government. I mean, it's the most medieval government on the planet, I think. There's only a king. There's no parliament. You're entirely subject to the largesse of the king. It's a young population that has access to the outside world in terms of information. So they're riding a tiger, aren't they?
Oh, they absolutely are for all kinds of reasons. I mean, look, I agree fundamentally that this is a terrible place. Now, it's managed to mobilize an incredible PR regime, and it's got powerful supporters inside the United States, inside Britain and elsewhere, many of whom profit from the arms industry and from other kinds of connections. But there's also a kind of misperception, I think, amongst influential American foreign policy thinkers in particular, who think that Saudi Arabia is a relatively moderate liberal place. This is a coercive, violent regime that brutally stamps out expression. It cracks down and crushes minorities. It imposes a strict system of gender apartheid. And this is not a happy or a friendly government. I mean, the Saudis are fascinating, and they're mixed, and it's heterogeneous, and it's culturally rich, and it's a wonderful place to spend time. But it's a brutal government.
So then they're fighting against the tide of history, aren't they?
Well, I mean, they've hung on for quite a long time. I mean, as a historian,
well, they got a lot of money, right?
They do have a lot of money. I mean, look, I mean, the other part of this, the tiger part, right? I mean, where things could spin out of control. I don't think it's necessarily going to be along ideological lines. I don't think the Islamists are going to rise up and throw the El Saud out of power. But we haven't talked about this. I mean, the Saudis have all kinds of reasons to worry about their medium to long-term health, their political health. This is a place that's dependent on energy entirely for its political economy. They have to maintain high prices, but high prices enable all kinds of consuming countries to think about alternative forms of energy. The Saudis can't guarantee their own financial or economic security, say, over the next two decades. If oil becomes less important to the global economy, then the Saudis face a number of really potentially pressing political problems, the most important of which is they won't be able to generate the kind of revenue that they need to continue to buy off the opposition and those at home who don't like them.
Well, in terms of what the Egyptians are requiring from Qatar, I mean, you've got the Saudis threatening to blockade, right? And that's wouldn't that seriously shut down the country? I mean, its only border is with Saudi Arabia, isn't it, Qatar?
Yeah, I don't think this is a serious threat. I mean, I think this, and we don't know for sure that it's actually been issued in a way that that makes sense. I mean, there's a lot of reporting going on, and there's certainly a lot of rumor mongering. But I don't know how credibly we should take Saudi Arabia's, kind of grandstanding that it can isolate Qatar in the region. I mean, look, the Saudis don't have, I often sit in rooms with people who want to think about Saudi Arabia's ability to project its own power. There's a reason that the Saudis remain dependent on the United States for its security assurances, and that's because the Saudis are basically ineffective militarily. But they've been defeated consistently by a group of ragtag rebels in North Yemen. So how successfully could they really impose some kind of a blockade or embargo on Qatar? I don't think that would be particularly effective. But rhetorically, it's meant to raise concern and to try to compel Qatar to fall back into line. What's interesting is that Doha has refused to do so far.
Well, apparently these threats were made by the Saudi foreign minister, Saud bin Faisal, in a foreign minister's meeting of the Gulf Cooperation Council in Riyadh last week. But there's been no follow-up, I take it. There's not been no military deployments and not like Putin threatening Ukraine.
Not that I know of. No. I would be shocked. Foreign ministers' meetings are great places for lots of heated rhetoric, finger-pointing, and for venting some frustration. And certainly the Saudis wanted to make a point. But I would be the first to beg forgiveness from those folks who watch if the Saudis either on the one hand really intended to follow through with such a thing, and on the other, if they could actually do it. Because I don't think either is realizable.
And from the point of view of the demands being made by Egypt on Qatar, I mean, they've put a bunch of Al Jazeera people on trial in Cairo, and they're demanding the extradition of this prominent Islamic cleric, Yusuf Karadawi, I should say, who's widely seen as a spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he's in Doha, and apparently he appears regularly on Al Jazeera, criticizing Egypt's military government as well as its Saudi and backers in the Gulf.
Yeah, Karadawi has a long history of being influential on Al Jazeera. He's been a central feature of their satellite programming for more than a decade, and he is one of the most visible Muslim Brotherhood figures in the Arab world, and certainly has poked at the Saudis in the past, as well as the secular, or at least the non-Islamist political leadership in Egypt over time. The Egyptian part of this is really interesting, right? So Sisi's coming to power, and he's apparently poised to run for president, and to attempt to, in many ways, reinvigorate the military presidential tradition in Egypt. But a Sisi-headed government will not be like a Mubarak-headed regime. It's far from clear that Sisi has either a clear vision or the capacity to create a viable economy in Egypt. Egypt remains terribly vulnerable. And there's also, of course, revolutionary memory, and there's all kinds of reasons to think that Egyptians and that the Egyptian revolutionary movement is not over. So it's with this in mind, I think, that Sisi is is doing all that he can do to appeal to his paymasters in Riyadh by framing both his domestic and regional policies in ways that reflect Saudi Arabia's anxieties, probably more than his own. And I think this explains, for example, why Egypt withdrew its own ambassador from Doha, but also why there are these kind of theatrical, cartoonish characteristics to how Egypt is managing its own domestic political situation. I mean, it really borders on the absurd, and it's unsustainable.
So do you think that the Saudis, at the end of the day, are going to just waste a lot of money on Egypt? I mean, you're saying earlier that they've got power, they've got money, they throw their weight around. They're essentially taking on an economic basket case with a general
right.
who's not ever going to be popular with his people. The Americans right. aren't comfortable dealing with him, even though they have this longstanding deal going back to Camp David. He's toying with, getting the Russians to supply him with military aid. I don't see him as a viable leader for Egypt over the long term.
No, I agree completely. No, I think this is a mad, desperate gamble that's driven by a lot of urgency in the moment. I would be surprised if the Saudis had actually thought this through, or Sisi for that matter, about what the long-term implications are going to be. I don't think it's sustainable. I think it's going to become increasingly expensive. The Saudis can't afford to continue to subsidize sclerotic, failing, aging, corrupt regimes around the region. They can barely sustain their own, which has similar dynamics. I think this is a ticking time bomb for lots of folks, not only heads of state and those who seek to keep power, but also for those who oppose them. You know, I mean, my view is that the Saudis are encouraging and invigorating the worst pathological and dangerous forces across the region. And they, too, may pay a price. But I'm pretty sure that even outside of Saudi Arabia, there will be a heavy price to pay.
So the message here is that even though it sounds alarming that Saudi Arabia is threatening to blockade its neighbor Qatar by land and sea unless it cuts ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, closes Al Jazeera, and expels the U.S. think tanks, the Brookings and Rand Corporation's think tanks there, this is not going to end up as much of a crisis. That's the message you're giving us, right? Other people are alarmed by it, but you're not alarmed.
Well, I don't think that the GCC rift, I don't think that the Saudi spat with Doha is the most significant angle here. I mean, I think the other regional dimensions, mm-hmm. The way that this particular conflict, for example, papers over or directs our attention away from the very thing that we just talked about with respect to the sustainability of Egypt's political order, which is vulnerable and, you know, sure. I mean, in a very dangerous place. Those are more pressing issues, and Saudi Arabia's influence there is more important than a contest over whether or not Al Jazeera is going to broadcast members of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is a fight the Saudis have been having with Qatar for a long time.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Toby Jones.
Ian, good to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Jones, as professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. From 2008 to 2009, he was a fellow at Princeton University's Oil, Energy and Middle Eastern Project. And from 2004 to 2006, he worked as a political analyst of the Persian Gulf for the International Crisis Group, where he wrote about political reform and sectarianism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A quiet voice.